Welcome to Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller. Colonel Scott Buren was commissioned as second lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps in May of 1982 after finishing a Bachelor of Science degree in business management at State University of New York, Binghamton. He served for 30 years, retiring as a colonel on September 1st, 2012. He was then employed by the Pennsylvania State University Applied Research Laboratory, State College, Pennsylvania, as a non-lethal weapons course instructor from 2013 to 2020. He's currently the executive director of Cor Christi Trinitate, a nonprofit dedicated to the development of moral conscience and the renewal of ethics, moral leadership, and spirituality in vocations. He's also a co-founder and the president of the J. Sherwood McGinnis Jr. War, Peace, and Justice Project, and currently resides in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, home of the Army War College. In Kurt Vonnegut's best-selling novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, he recounted a conversation about his book. You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? No. What do you say, Harrison Starr? I say, why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead? Thank you, Colonel Buren, for joining me today and for embracing peace in the face of such long odds.
Max, it's a pleasure to be with you today, and I thank you for this opportunity. We go back a little bit, if I may, before I go into really the history of the J. Sherwood McGinnis Jr. War, Peace, and Justice Project. But it was our sojourn together to Denver, Colorado for the Peace Blanket Project for the homeless. And I tell you what, that really changed me in many ways. And it wasn't just that, but it was also the camaraderie with you, Max, and the rest of the group. Really, I'll never forget it. And it was just a great, great honor. And the other thing was coming back, I stopped at the Dwight D. Eisenhower Museum. And that will play out in a little bit later in this discussion, because Eisenhower is very important to the War, Peace, and Justice Project.
Just to update people who are listening here, I met you through my former co-host, Pat LaMarche, who also lives in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which is where you're at now. And she had met you because of the vigils that you conducted about the Ukrainian war every week. And she met you through that. And I think somehow or another, the word about the Homeless Remembrance Blanket Project came out, and you volunteered to help us deliver blankets and display the blankets in Denver, Colorado last year. So you're right. That's how we met. And the camaraderie of both of us being retired military, I think, played into that a bit as well.
Yeah, it's a privilege to know Pat. And of course, you know, Pat really is a humanitarian, and God bless the work she does. And so I'm proud to be part of that. And I was glad to be part of that caravan, so to speak. But I know we're here to talk about the War, Peace, and Justice Project. So you, when you opened up, it's a long name. And if I give some background there, it's named after J. Sherwood McGinnis, who was a dear colleague, friend, and neighbor. Sherwood was a career Foreign Service officer who passed away prematurely 4 years ago. And so part of that legacy, we named the Carlisle War, Peace, and Justice Project after him. So he's still with us in spirit. He guides us. He was an incredible human being. And if it wasn't for him, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation today. He's a principal co-founder of the War, Peace, and Justice Project.
Very good. And I want to go back to, you had in discussions we'd had before, you had mentioned Cor Christi Trinitate, and that was formed decades ago while you were still in the military. Can you explain how that came to be and what its significance was for what has transpired with the J. Sherwood McGinnis work?
Well, that takes me back in time. As a young first lieutenant, serving at Subic Bay, Republic of the Philippines, at Marine Barracks there. And I think I was all of maybe 24, 25 years old. But the history of Cor Christi Trinitate, which is absolutely critical because they are the principal financial supporters of the War, Peace, and Justice Project. And that allows us to schedule and execute events that are free and open to the public. We charge no fees at all for people to attend our events. And so without them, without Cor Christi, we would not be viable. So let me go back in history. So 1985, so I met this incredible Navy chaplain, George Tracy. He was ordained very late in life. And it was the whole background of Corpus Christi and the War, Peace, and Justice Project really revolves around ethics. Chaplain George Tracy was asked to become a Navy chaplain at a very at age 52 or 53. I think he was ordained at age 50. And he provided a ethics presentation to a group of naval officers in Norfolk, Virginia. And in that audience was the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral James Watkins, who ended up retiring, became the Secretary of Energy, et cetera. Well, he heard of Chaplain George Tracy, or actually it was Father George Tracy at the time. And he was speaking about ethics. And Admiral Watkins said, "I need people of your caliber to become chaplains and instruct our uniformed personnel on ethics." And he did. And he's probably was the oldest chaplain in the Naval Chaplaincy Corps at age 53 and probably the oldest Lieutenant JG in the Navy. But we met, and we met at a feeding program that was helping out the destitute in the surrounding area of Subic Bay, very poor area. If you've ever been to the Philippines, it's really poverty. I don't want to say it's a third world country. That would be disingenuous to the Filipino people, but very poor. And so we met, and that introduction really became a lifelong friendship. Father Tracy was so steeped in ethics. He met Cardinal Jaime Sin, who was the Archbishop of Manila. And Cardinal Sin asked him to conduct conferences for the Filipino Army chaplains on ethics, which he did. And at the time, Chaplain Tracy said, you know, we need to establish a foundation to continue this work. And so at that time, Corpus Christi Trinitate was created. So the principal founder was Chaplain George Tracy. I'm a co-founder. Lieutenant Michael Waters, who was a Navy JAG officer at the time, as a co-founder, and Cardinal Jaime Sin. And the mission statement of Corpus Christi, which does play into War, Peace, and Justice, is that the renewal of ethics, moral leadership, and spirituality in vocations to address the poverty of affluence. And just very quickly, won't go into greater detail, but Mother Teresa plays a part in this. And she thought that the spiritual poverty was greater than the material poverty in this country, being the United States. Well, what was significant about what happened in the Philippines, it really planted a seed in me that I think blossomed as my career went forward, and certainly after retirement, is in 1986, Marcos Revolution occurred. Marcos was a dictator. There were extrajudicial killings that were ongoing, and the people of the Philippines had had enough. And the assassination of Corazon Aquino's husband occurred, who was a major politician. And so the people had had enough, and a coup occurred. And the Philippine Marine Corps remained loyal to the President Ferdinand Marcos, and went to, were taking their forces with armored vehicles, tanks, to defend the palace, Malacanang Palace, to protect Marcos. And Cardinal Jaime Sin, who Catholic, again, and of course, the Philippines is a heavily Catholic society, called the people to the streets. And the people responded. They blocked the armored vehicles. The Philippine Marine Corps stopped their reinforcement. And the coup was over, and Marcos left the country, and the rest was history. And I want to say they're a more democratic country today than they were back in, you know, in the 80s and certainly in 1986. So what's the moral to that story is? The moral is it's probably at least the only event in history that I'm aware of where nonviolence was used to overthrow a dictator, resulting in no casualties or deaths. And that, when you reflect on that, that's an amazing story of how nonviolence can transform conflict in society. And that's something that we have to learn, and it's something we've integrated into the War, Peace, and Justice Project. I know it's a long story, but it's an important one because Chaplain Tracy passed away in 2009. He left a legacy for us with some monies, and we're able to continue that mission through the War, Peace, and Justice Project. And when I say that, when we talk about the renewal of ethics, moral leadership, and spirituality and vocations, what we're really doing in the War, Peace, and Justice Project is addressing the poverty of affluence in the military community. And that poverty is basically thinking that we can use violence and force to transform conflict. And that's a poverty. It's an intellectual poverty. It's a failure of moral imagination. And frankly, that mentality, using lethality, force, and violence, has not served us well since the end of World War II.
So, Scott, can you tell me the purpose and objectives of the J. Sherman McGinnis Jr. War, Peace, and Justice Project?
Yeah, Max, again, the purpose is again, to get the energize the American citizenry to engage with their elected officials in the hopes that our nation can transform conflict through building peace with justice, and not just using force as a way to transform conflict. We were able to do that by educating individuals and organizations and institutions so they can understand the drama of human conflict and hopefully inspire them to become advocates for creating a community of conscience to transform conflict through building peace and justice. And we do it through three objectives. One is to illuminate the human drama of conflict and its impact on society. We also try to create opportunities for civil dialogue. And again, as I mentioned before, 47 or 48, whatever number I use previously, events that we've had, that's how we create discourse in the community. And then the third one, and probably the most important, this is an ongoing one, and that's to promote ethical and strategic approaches to peace building. We have got to be able to design a government and the military institutions that can use creative ways, moral imagination, for lack of a better term, to be able to solve conflict other than using lethal force. Certainly, we're advocates, you know, sometimes in order to have a just society or correct an injustice, sometimes force has to be used. We realize that, but it has to have utility. So again, those are the purpose and those are our objectives. And again, the last one there, promoting ethical and strategic approaches to peace building, is an ongoing one that will be with us for a long time. And we hope that other communities will be able to replicate the model that we're creating here in Carlisle. Again, this concept of a peace building initiative, building a community of conscience. So that is essentially what we do. And the methodology, again, is using all the humanities, film, theater, literature, art, history, and music. And that's the greatest way to open the hearts and minds of people to what we're attempting to do.
Talking about J. Sherwood McGinnis, so you've got the new foundation that was formed, and it seems like that was a major friendship that you had that resulted in that. So talk about your friendship with J. Sherwood McGinnis Jr. and how your current foundation began.
I taught at the U.S. Army War College while still on active duty from 2008 to 2012. I retired, took a year sabbatical, so to speak, watched my son play ice hockey, travel ice hockey in New England in the Northeast. And I got an itching to get back into the profession. And so I became an advisor to the Peacekeeping Stability Operations, which was resident at Carlisle Barracks at the time. And we were looking at, obviously, Iraq had concluded for the most part. However, the war in Afghanistan was still ongoing. And there was a concern that we were not winning the war. And so what I did, I took a survey of course material in the U.S. Army War College curriculum. And that was basically looking at what courses were related to peace and justice while my time at the Peacekeeping Institute. And what I found was deeply concerning. There were none. And now before 2012, there were several courses that were related to stability operations, et cetera. And of course, we were still involved in Afghanistan, so that made sense. But President Obama made a pivot to the Pacific around 2011, 2012. And so essentially there was discussion that we would no longer participate in long-term peace building activities or nation building. And so it would be peer-to-peer competition, China, Russia, et cetera. So most of those peace-related courses were taken out of the curriculum. And I'll talk about that later because it plays out in today's world because we've lost all our government-affiliated peace-building feedback mechanisms. So here we are. I'm there 2013, 2014 at the Peacekeeping Institute. And I realized that there has to be a discussion. I met Sherwood McGinnis as a fellow faculty member. He had since retired from the Foreign Service, but he was teaching at the War College. And he was also an adjunct professor in the Russian department at Dickinson College, which is also resident here in Carlisle. So we were talking and we said, you know, we're not doing well in Afghanistan. And already we're approaching the longest war in U.S. history. And that would, of course, contrast with Vietnam. And up to that time, Vietnam was the longest war in U.S. history. But since we know now, after the withdrawal in 2021, Afghanistan has surpassed Vietnam as the longest war in U.S. history. So we thought that there should be a discussion at the War College about the Afghanistan war and why we were not, you know, based on our presumed capabilities, that being, you know, we're having the best defense colleges, the best resource military, trained military, but yet we weren't accomplishing our national security objectives. And so that ended up being a thesis question we wanted to pursue. So in 2015, we began this planning for a discussion to offer to the War College to consider, to address to all the students, staff, and faculty. So we teamed up with the Association of the U.S. Army, which is the Army's professional organization. And I was a member of the local board, even being a Marine. I'm still part of the Association of the U.S. Army, as a proud member. And we proposed a discussion, a presentation, and this presentation ended up being titled Moral Agency and Strategic Competency. And we sought the services of General Jim Dubik, who's retired, Lieutenant General Jim Dubik, retired Army three-star officer, and Ambassador James Jeffrey, who was a former ambassador to Iraq during the Iraq insurgency, counterinsurgency. And he was also ended up being the first in the first Trump administration as a special envoy to Syria. So those were our two senior panelists. And it really was extremely well done. But what we realized at the time that it was just a small sliver and it didn't have the efficacy that it needed to have. And when I say by efficacy, when you talk about these things and the failures of use of force, it has to be a sustained discussion. And you have to look at lessons identified, and you've got to turn those lessons identified into lessons learned. And frankly, we did not learn those lessons from Vietnam, nor did we apply them adequately to the entire time in Iraq, as well as Afghanistan. So here we are, ended panel was May of 2016, didn't have the efficacy. But what it did, it gave us the initiative and the spark to continue working this issue. It took a while, but we finally, in 2019, Sherwood and I got together. We approached the former president of Dickinson College, Margie Ensign, and we expressed our concern about our nation's inability to accomplish our national security objectives at great price and cost to national treasure and blood. And she jumped on this and said, I'm with you. Let's do this. And she said, you need to talk to the commandant of the U.S. Army War College, General Kem at the time. This is, again, 2019. We did. He said, we're in. We're supportive. And then we went to see Dean Daniel Conway, the current dean at the Penn State Dickinson Law School, also resident here in Carlisle. And she says, I'm in this, too. But what she said, though, was important. She said, this needs to go outside to a community larger than Carlisle. And that stuck with me back then. And we will talk about current Ukrainian exhibit at the Dayton International Peace Museum. But that she planted a seed in that. So we started generating, taking a look how we could conduct this project or symposium, as we called it then. And then COVID struck us. And it sidelined us for 2 years. But it gave us time to think through this, develop a comprehensive campaign, so to speak, and how we were going to address the issues of war, peace, and justice. And war, peace, and justice, I'll go back, as I mentioned before, President Eisenhower or General Eisenhower. On my business card, I'll read this, and the significance of why war, peace, and justice is important. Eisenhower in 1956 stated, the peace we seek and need means much more than mere absence of war. It means the acceptance of law and the fostering of justice in all the world. Eisenhower I think we take a look at him as a supreme Allied commander of Allied forces during World War II. But my belief is when he came president, I think he realized a greater understanding of force. And of course, I think he foresaw the blossoming of the military-industrial complex. And so this all comes into play in the establishment of the War, Peace, and Justice Project. And here's the thing about Carlisle. It is a unique community. And we see it as a laboratory to experiment with war, peace, and justice. And here's why. You have Dickinson College, actually one of the first colleges in the United States because it was created after the signing of the Constitution. The oldest school, I think, is Harvard. But as far as a new nation established by the Constitution, Dickinson, I think they can make the claim as the first college in the United States. That can be debated. But it was founded by a signatory of the Declaration of Independence, Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was a humanitarian. And Rush was also a physician general for the Continental Army early on. He participated in the Battle of Trenton with George Washington. I think he amputated a British officer's leg or arm. But he detested war. And he had a falling out with Washington as well. There was some black marketeering that was going on in the Continental Army by the Surgeon General. And Washington, frankly, was too distracted with the war to do much about it. And this upset the apple cart with Rush. So Rush resigned his commission. But the key point here is when President George Washington, when he became president, he established the Department of War in 1789. And it was Rush who came back and he wrote an incredible essay, which is in the National Archives. And basically, he advocated for a Department of Peace to counter the Department of War. And his argument was, if there was going to be a Department of War during a time of peace, there should be a Department of Peace during a time of war. He was a man ahead of his time and probably a signatory of the Declaration of Independence who probably should be given greater notoriety. And he was a humanitarian for the rest of his life, father of modern medicine, psychiatry. He was the first formally trained physician in the United States, having graduated from Edinburgh University in Scotland. So that's Dickinson. I consider them the peace pillar of the war, peace, and justice. Moving to Penn State Dickinson Law. Dickinson Law originally was the oldest law school in Pennsylvania and the first law school in Pennsylvania. They merged with Penn State, so hence the name Penn State Dickinson Law. That's the justice piece. And then, you have the war piece with the U.S. Army Senior Defense War College here in Carlisle Barracks. So you have this incredible panoply of these academic institutions here at a county seat. And this is why I think there's an opportunity or potential to be a focus point for discussions of the highest caliber when it comes to war, peace, and justice. And I'll try to tie that in later with a diminishment of our peace building feedback mechanisms that have happened primarily under the current administration. So let me finish that conversation. So we are currently a 501c3 nonprofit. We're small. We're all volunteers. There's several of us. General Jim Dubik is our chair. He lives in Alexandria, Virginia. Our senior advisor is General Sir Rupert Smith, who wrote the definitive book on the use of force that's used at various war colleges. He's a retired UK British officer. His history, his credentials are impeccable. And so we're blessed to have these incredible gentlemen and the volunteers. So I'll finish by saying we're small, but we punch above our weight. I'll leave it at that.
Well, and I've been impressed that you've gotten some pretty big exposure. Like, I want to talk specifically about the upcoming art exhibit at the Dayton International Peace Museum. So you're going to be debuting the Our Fire is Stronger Than Your Bombs exhibit, representing Ukrainian art in Dayton, Ohio, of all places. So can you tell me something about Dayton, Ohio and this art exhibit?
I would like to discuss one thing. I'll jump right into the Ukrainian art exhibit. So to date, we've had 48 events and seven of those have been related to artwork. And again, like I say, we punch above our weight. That's an amazing number. And most of those events are done twice, sometimes three times. And what we like to do, our methodology is we like to do is hold them in different venue sites. For instance, we had an event last week on politics. Our first venue was at the Bosler Library here in Carlisle, which is a wonderful venue site. And then the second day for that same event was at the Cumberland County Historical Society. So we try to mix it up, try to maximize participation from the audience, et cetera. Okay, so let me get to your question. So this is our seventh exhibit. And so the Ukrainian art exhibit, Our Fire is Stronger Than Your Bombs, was initially co-curated by two wonderful Ukrainian women. And it first showed here, actually it first showed in Dartmouth College in, New Hampshire. And then it came to us in April of 2024. And it was here for about 2 months. Incredibly powerful. 25 images related to the conflict. They were poster-sized illustrations. 9 different Ukrainian illustrators who some still live in Ukraine. Many of them became refugees in Poland, Germany, etc. So we realized the power of this exhibit. And then it came out again for a wonderful documentary, which come up in conversation again for the Dayton International Peace Museum. We brought a partial showing out again in September of last year. And so again, we realized it needed to be shown. I mean, we're in the going into the fifth year of the Russo-Ukraine conflict. And frankly, it's kind of fallen off the radar scope. And that breaks my heart because the loss of civilian and military life, and for both sides, it's right. A tragedy should never have happened. So in August of last year, I told a buddy of mine, I said, we need to make a pilgrimage to the International Peace Museum. Never been there. I had heard about it. So we did. We went. And we met the wonderful executive director, Alice Basoria-Young, who embraced us. We told her what we did and who we are. And we told her about we had this wonderful art exhibit. And she said, I'm fascinated by it. Perhaps we could do it in the future. We returned again in November for another visit. She was all in. She said, Scott, I have an opening in the spring of 2026, I would love to display this exhibit. 3 weeks ago, the same buddy of mine, we made the sojourn again to Dayton International Peace Museum, and we installed the exhibit. So all 25 artwork is art prints are up, and we've enhanced it with some information about drone warfare. Of course, that's fascinating and interesting, what's happening to the change of character of war in today's world. Not just in Ukraine, but now in the Middle East, the way drones are being used to attack targets and personnel. We address the taking over 20,000 children by the Russians. That's also in the exhibit. So we enhanced it, and it's really powerful. And so it's even going to be more powerful because now this has become a collaborative effort with the University of Dayton, which is a Marian Catholic Institute, about 8,500 students, which is also located in Dayton. And so what they're going to add is the peace building part to the exhibit. So we installed the war and conflict part. And so they're going to add and augment it with the peace building part with beautiful Marian iconography that is related to Ukraine. Many of these artworks came from Ukrainian artists from Ukraine. It's going to be an incredibly powerful exhibit when complete, which should be in a couple of weeks. So we're looking forward to an official opening, I think the end of May, 29th of May has been batted around. But in addition to that, there's a wonderful documentary film, award-winning film. It's 29 minutes long, and it's called A Return Home. And we became associated with that film. We co-sponsored its premiere here at Carlisle at Dickinson College. And Professor Jennifer Blythe, who's a music professor there, she played the musical score for the film. And when it was showed here, she actually on stage with a grand piano played the musical score while the film was being played. I don't know what magic they did that, but she was able to do it. And so it's anticipated that that film with Jennifer and a colleague will come to Dayton International Peace Museum, and there'll be a premiere of that film on or about the 29th of May as well. So I think this is one of the most powerful exhibits that I'm anticipating it will be that I've ever been to when you start merging war and peace and justice together.
So you mentioned visiting the Dayton International Peace Museum, and you said during those visits, you had kind of a David and Goliath moment in visiting that. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, that was pretty significant. And so during our August 2025 visit, we first went to the Peace Museum, and it's not a large museum, but they also punch above their weight. It's really superbly done. And just a little history about the International Peace Museum. It was established in Dayton because of the Dayton Peace Accords. And these were the peace negotiations that occurred in 1995 in Dayton, Ohio, particularly at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is also located in Dayton. And these negotiations ended up seizing the Bosnia-Herzegovina war, and that just ravaged Serbia, Bosnia, Croatia, et cetera, during the early 90s. So that's principally the reason why it was established in Dayton. I apologize to Alice Young there, because she may have a better version of that, but that's the best I can do. But here's the kicker. The Peace Museum in Dayton is the only brick and mortar peace museum in the entire United States, compared to over 400 military museums in the United States. Now, they range from small unit museums, maybe at the battalion level, all the way to the big service museums like the Marine Corps Museum in Quantico, Virginia, the Army Museum at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And so in Dayton, as I mentioned, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, is the National Air Force Museum. By far, it's the finest military museum and the largest one that I have ever visited. It is amazing. And when I went there after visiting the Peace Museum and saw how extensive it was, 8 hangars full of aircraft going back from World War I to present day, just massive. And it is so incredible. You just have to go. Maybe it's a wonder of the world now. I don't know. But the thing, so this is my David and Goliath moment. So here you have the largest military museum in the United States, over 400 military museums, and you have one brick and mortar peace museum, the Dayton International Peace Museum. I don't know, maybe it's 2,400 square feet, maybe 2,500 square feet. So you can see the contrast here. And that was frankly kind of rocked my heels. And I realized how imbalanced war and peace has become in the country's ethos. And this is not healthy for our society whatsoever.
Yeah, no doubt. That brings up another point, and I'm going to take a little bit of time to review this, but Nixon campaigned on a slogan when I was growing up of peace through strength. So that was in the face of the Vietnam War. He's bringing up this slogan of peace through strength. And then when the Vietnam War started to look more challenging and we wanted to get out of there, the people wanted to get out of there, he changed this slogan to peace with honor in that kind of humiliating situation in Vietnam. And you noted to me that Washington was famous for making the quote of peace through strength. That was kind of something that he held on to. And you have a different notion of what that saying should have been. So tell me what you think about the peace through strength idea.
Yeah, so I kind of paraphrased Washington's quote. It's a little bit longer, but not much longer. And it keeps on being that same basic quote tends to be talked to, especially by senior defense officials, civilian defense officials, and the military. And granted, we want a strong military. We want to be able to be successful when we deploy and employ our national treasure and blood. But that hasn't always been the case. And so let me try to frame all this. So again, I would reverse it and say this really should be about strength through peace. And it goes back again to President Eisenhower. Eisenhower, you know, talked about the military-industrial complex, which was part of his last public speech to the American people in 1961. And when I look at his life and spending time at the museum in Abilene, Texas, which everyone should go to who wears a uniform. And if you don't, you should also go, because you see this man who led an incredible life, who went from serving the military, senior Allied commander during World War II, to president. But he understood the concern and risk with having too much of a robust military contrasted to civilian society, et cetera. So 61, I'll talk about that speech in a minute, but let me go back to a speech he made in 1953, and I'm going to quote him directly. This was a cautionary tale that he informed the American public. He said, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the clouds of war, it is humanity hanging on a cross of iron. Famous speech. It's a must to listen to. And of course, you know, the French were still involved in Indochina, which unfortunately we ended up getting involved with in the 60s, initially during the Kennedy administration. Then, of course, greater involvement, escalation during the Johnson administration. So Eisenhower, with that cautionary tale, warned us. And then he does it again when he leaves office in 61 or 62, before Kennedy was elected into office. And then he goes on to give another quote. And that quote, which I often quote in public when I discuss this, is that, now this is taken from the text of that 1961 speech known as the Military-Industrial Complex. And this is important because this is another reason why we're doing what we're doing with the War, Peace, and Justice Project. He said, and I quote, only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together. Again, he's foreshadowing or presenting a cautionary tale to us. So let me go back to Washington's quote, peace through strength. My concern, and I think this is the concern of every American should be, is we have a defense budget approaching, at least last year's defense budget, approaching $1 trillion. And as I understand it, the current administration is requesting $1.5 trillion for its next defense budget. So if you take that number and you take what Eisenhower, his cautionary tale, and then let me go back further in history to post-World War II, and that would be the Korean War, that would be the Vietnam War, would be Somalia, it would be Iraq, it would be Afghanistan, and to include our current conflict in the Middle East. I would argue, and I love my country 30 years, my father served in two wars, World War II and Korea. My son currently serves on active duty in the Marine Corps. I would argue that the return on investment in our military has not been very positive. And so let me go back to that second quote, only alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together. Why this is significant is that the American people have taken a knee, I think, and there's lots of reasons for it. It's not apathy. I call it an anesthetized conscience. We're distracted. We've got an economy that's not doing well. We don't have a draft, so we have less than 1% of the American population serving in the military. So this is why we do what we do with the War, Peace, and Justice Project. It's to offer these events and venues to the American citizenry, specifically to Carlisle, and to educate them on national security matters so they can influence their elected officials in Washington or at the local level here at the state level. And again, if you go back to the Constitution, this being our 250th anniversary of our nation, in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, the U.S. Congress is responsible for the general defense of the nation. They maintain the military. And so if the American citizenry, we the people, are not educated on national security matters, and we're not sending our sons and daughters in a draft form to fight our nation's wars or serve in the military, we have taken a knee. And what is happening is the war-making institutions are basically, you know, we've abrogated the ethical decision-making of going to war to a very few. And that's not healthy for our society. And this is why what we do here in Carlisle, and hopefully beyond, and hopefully what the International Peace Museum does, as small as they are, is this is why the American people need to be astute to what is happening. Our nation can't afford to continue down this road. The debt is increasing. So I would argue that, you know, we win every tactical engagement, frankly, but strategically, something's awry. And we got to figure this out.
When you mentioned that fact that a lot of people aren't affected because the draft is not being used, the draft has not been used since Vietnam. And we know that during the Vietnam War, there was an uproar about that war, which of course led to Nixon having to change his feelings on it. And okay, we do need to back off of this because so many of those national treasure and blood, as you said, of the country were involved in that as draftees. And now the number of people who actually know somebody who's involved in combat, and I think you brought up the fact to me of kind of that legacy enlistment, the people who know what's going on in the military, they're ones that their children and their grandchildren have enlisted after them. And that's a very small portion of the people who are affected.
Yes. So my son's a legacy Marine. Again, I served 30 years. My father served total of 27. Most of those were in the reserves, but he fought in two wars in the Pacific on one of the most violent clashes in the Pacific on the battle for Iwo Jima as a young second lieutenant mortar platoon commander who suffered from post-traumatic stress, which I would suggest that Kurt Vonnegut was probably also afflicted with post-traumatic stress, but I'm not sure we're going to have time for that. But I think you'd make that argument. Most individuals who serve in active combat do not come back the same person they left. That's it. So going back to, again, less than 1% of the American population has served in the military. We no longer have conscription or a draft. Most people say, well, we have a volunteer force. I would say it's better termed a all-recruited volunteer force, because we have a very heavy active duty recruiting force that really sells the military. And many who join the military, it really works out well for them, a trade profession, but you're still potentially could go to harm's way. So I think that has created a civil military divide. Since we no longer have a draft, we have this all recruited volunteer force. I would argue that we have now a professional military force. So a lot of people use the term warrior, and I frown upon that use of that term. Citizen soldier really to me is the proper term, because we enter the military as citizens, we go through training, etc., but we're still a citizen soldier. And then when we come back out, we're a citizen again, having served in the military as a veteran. And I think with an all professional career force, where it's created this chasm between the citizenry and the military. And it's just not healthy for our country. And I'm not advocating for a draft. What I am advocating for is American citizenry involvement in national security matters with their elected officials. That's the voice they can have. That's the voice they should have. And it goes also back how we prosecute war. And if I could just offer this, my concern is the way we prosecute war, whether it be Vietnam, which was intense lethality, which we ended up losing at a great cost, 58,000 American servicemen lives and women. And we're seeing this play out again. And we saw it played out in Iraq in 2003. We saw it played out in the entire war in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2021. And this sense that we can use lethality and force to transform conflict to a less violent means. And frankly, it's not working. It hasn't worked since the end of World War II. And the history is there. And this is where we shouldn't be thinking about lethality. We should be thinking about the utility of force. Because if that force is not having utility, it has no transformative power. And so, again, I would argue that the natural movement of nature is toward peace. But in conflict, it's the utility of force that's either going to increase violence in that conflict, or it's going to transform it to a less violent relationship with the adversary. And if we continue to talk about lethality and not in the context of lethality having utility, we'll continue to fail and have a poor return on investment of our military at great cost to national treasure and blood. And that, again, should be a concern of every citizen.
Scott, earlier you mentioned this David and Goliath moment while visiting the International Peace Museum in Dayton and mentioned that the number of brick and mortar organizations highlighting peace were significantly eclipsed compared to the number of buildings honoring military might. And I think there's also that feeling that our attempts to create discussions about peace are eclipsed by discussions of war, particularly right now where we are redefining the Department of Defense as the Department of War and things like that. So can you talk to me about what you feel the impact is of that shift in language?
We mentioned the dichotomy between the Peace Museum and the 400 military museums. So it plays out in a very different way, in a very concerning way, given contemporary times. I did mention Dr. Benjamin Rush, and so I call this the Rush problem. And I have a slide that I typically will present during my discussions to the community. And it's a scale, and war is heavily weighted, and again, peace is up in the air, as you can imagine, because there's just not the density of peace-related institutions. So it does get worse, and it's of greater concern, especially given the contemporary times. So I also make the statement that since 2013, we have lost almost all of our government-affiliated peace-building feedback mechanisms in North America. And I say peace-building feedback mechanisms and government-affiliated because, let me explain. So I started in 2013, and in 2013, the Pearson Peacekeeping Center, which was internationally renowned, it was headquartered in Nova Scotia. Countries from all over the world sent their peacekeepers there to be trained on peacebuilding and peacekeeping. They shuttered their doors in 2013. And then fairly recently in 2019, the Center for Complex Operations, which was the National Defense University, which is the senior defense college for the Department of Defense, located in Washington, D.C., they closed their doors. They were the kind of a think tank for stability operations, nation building, et cetera. So they closed in 2019. And I also mentioned the peacekeeping stability operations in Carlisle Barracks, PKSOI. So when I was there in 2013, 2014, we had a staff of about 48, sometimes 50. But in about 2018, 2019, the government started to dismantle that institute as well. So for the longest time, they were diminished to about 8, 9, 10 people. They're back up to 30 now. But here's the kicker. They've since moved the headquarters under the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth. And they removed peacekeeping from their name. They're now known as the U.S. Army Combined Arms Center Security Force Assistance and Stability Integration. No longer have peacekeeping in their name. Let me continue here. So the U.S. Agency for International Development was shuttered by the Trump administration last year. Several thousand employees did incredible international work on building institutions, et cetera, no longer with us. The U.S. Institute of Peace was closed last year by the Trump administration. I think it was renamed the Trump Institute of Peace, but as far as the practitioners and the experts there are no longer there. And then the Women Department of Defense's Women, Peace, and Security, that was an initiative that President Trump signed into law in 2019. And that Women, Peace, and Security was a spinoff of the United Nations initiative probably 15, 20 years ago. And so that was shut down by Secretary Hegseth last year as well. And so the last one was, when it comes to justice, was the Department of Justice's Community Relations Service, known as CRS, small entity, but they were shuttered in October of last year. And they were a group of people who were called upon by communities that were experiencing gun violence, drug problems, et cetera, and would do community building. And so, again, what I would argue, and I think this is a fact, almost all these government-affiliated peace-building feedback mechanisms have been dismantled or seriously diminished. And so you don't have anything now to kind of act as a governor against the Department of Defense. And I'm not going to use the Department of War. I'm sorry, it's still the Department of Defense as far as I'm concerned, as far as Congress is concerned, until that changes by law. So here we are. We're at this incredible imbalance at a trillion-dollar budget on defense, maybe going up to $1.5 trillion. And we've lost all our peace-building feedback mechanisms to kind of provide another perspective. And so lethality now dominates the game board.
Another good reason to encourage the listeners to pay closer attention to what's going on in terms of war and peace, and add your voice to the movement to bring peace back into the discussion and develop an idea of strength through peace as opposed to the alternative to that. I think that's really important. I want to thank you, Scott, for joining me today. I've really benefited from being able to talk through this. I would like you to highlight the two organizations that you're involved with, get the URLs out there for those. And I also want to remind people about that exhibit in Dayton, the Our Fire is Stronger Than Your Bombs. If you want to tell us the specifics of when that could be seen in Dayton.
Yeah, so you can go now to see it. So our portion is installed. I believe in the next week or so, the University of Dayton, the Marion Library, will be installing their portion. But you can go today. Their hours are a little bit quirky. I think they're open Friday and Saturday, but you as a group, you can make a special arrangement to visit anytime during the week, and it certainly closed on Sunday. But you can go now and experience that Ukrainian art exhibit. It's so powerful. They're full-fledged posters depicting, again, the conflict, and they're incredible, beautifully illustrated. And so you talked about our website. So I encourage everybody to check our website out, www.warpeacejustice.org. You'll find some videos there from previous. We have a YouTube channel there. You can look at some of our previous events. We have some information about upcoming events, current events, et cetera. But I would like to at least put a spotlight on a sculpture relief that's on the website. And it's a sculpture relief of what has been termed Mourning Athena, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. And it's a relief sculpture that's in the Acropolis Museum in Athens. We were given permission to use it not for financial gain, but not for commercial use, which we do not do. And that Mourning Athena, to me, is very powerful. It's only about 18 inches high, and it goes back to 463 B.C., and it's believed that she's the mythical goddess of war, but also the goddess of wisdom and creation. And so she's leaning on her spear against a funeral pyre. And it's believed it's considered mourning Athena because she's mourning the loss of Athenian citizens and soldiers during the wars of Greece. And you'll find in the website too, a beautiful poem by John Levecki. And you can see the narrative, but you can also click on a link at the bottom of the poem that John Levecki, a resident of Williamsburg, Virginia, will read you the poem in his own voice. It's a two-part poem. It's Andromache to Hector and Hector to Andromache. Of course, if you're familiar with the Homer's classic, The Iliad, they were two principal players. And it's really a heart-wrenching poem because I hope what you'll feel is that they both know the end is coming soon. And it's a goodbye between two lovers, a husband and wife. And it's really a powerful. And so we use Athena as our logo of who she is. And it's not so much war. It's the use of force, the wisdom, and the virtue that comes in using force that determines whether that force will be transformative to peace or more violence. And I'll go back also to Aristotle. Aristotle, probably all familiar with Aristotle. I subscribe to his aphorism, so to speak. And that is war, the purpose of war is to achieve a better peace. And Aristotle should know this. He was the educator of probably the greatest commander in history, for good or bad, was Alexander the Great. Aristotle was his tutor. And I think that we should keep that war's purpose in mind throughout the centuries. Its purpose is to promote a better peace. And this is what we should reflect on as our nation moves through this anniversary year of 250 years of celebrating our history. But we were also founded, I believe, on violence and force. And I don't think we have time to discuss that. But thanks for the great opportunity, man, in allowing us to tell our message on the significance of peace and justice and how the American people can get involved, especially this year. You know, we the people, we have a voice. And we need to voice that to our elected officials. So again, the loss of national treasure and blood is mitigated, and we can have a better society, a more peaceful society.
Yeah, I thank you so much for joining us. And I think you're right. This would be a great way to show your individual patriotism and work for the cause of peace. As far as the exhibit goes, I'll give that URL too. If you want to know more about that display so that you can go visit it in Dayton, that's www.peacepeace.museum. And you can get all the details on the display. I know being relatively close to Dayton here in Indianapolis, I plan on making my pilgrimage over there. And I really am thankful that you were able to join us today and talk about all these important peace initiatives. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler. Original music by Jamie Calland. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.